Advocates for parole reform in Illinois equate life in prison to a death sentence. Later this hour, we'll revisit our conversation with the filmmakers behind Stateville Calling. The documentary follows the struggles of aging inmates in Illinois. But first, we'll talk about how the coronavirus has impacted some of the industries that rely on people being able to leave their houses, like restaurants and music venues. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. And the 21st starts right after this newscast. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick. According to the latest numbers from the Illinois Department of Public Health, more than 1,200 people have tested positive for the coronavirus in the state. 12 people have died. In an effort to help stop the spread of the coronavirus, employees here in Illinois and across the country have been told to work from home. But for people who work outside of a traditional office setting, oftentimes that is not an option. Last week, Governor J.B. Pritzker ordered all bars and restaurants in the state closed to dine-in customers through March 30th. Delivery, drive-through, and pickup can continue, but the decision has already had a profound impact on the industry. Last year, restaurant and food service jobs in Illinois accounted for 10% of overall employment in the state. That's more than 500,000 people. And that's according to the Illinois Restaurant Association. For more on how the food industry is being affected, we're joined on the line right now by Monica Ng. She is a reporter for WBEZ Chicago and Curious City. Monica, welcome back to the show and thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
And as always, those of you listening, we welcome your thoughts and questions. Are you a restaurant owner maybe affected by the stay-at-home order? Give us a call at 800-222-9455. Again, 800-222-9455. Monica, let me ask you, what does the stay-at-home order mean in practice for restaurants?
Well, it means that they can do curbside pickup, they can do delivery, they can do carryout, but no dine-in, no congregating in a restaurant. And, you know, some have been kind of working that out. You know, as people kind of like are waiting for their Starbucks coffee or waiting for their sandwich. But a lot of them have sorted it out by now.
I know it's a little empty. The streets are a little empty here in central Illinois. What about there in the Windy City? I mean, what is it like when you're driving around the restaurants that are normally
packed?
They
are very empty. Yeah, I'm trying not to go out as much as possible. But over the weekend, you know, I walked and when there was nice weather and that's even a little dicey because, you know, the sidewalks aren't that wide. You know, and so we're actually doing a story about how close you should let a jogger get to you if they're just passing on the sidewalk. But it's, things are super duper slow. A lot of people are ordering takeout and carryout. They have their questions about its safety, but that's something we dealt with in a story. But it's bleak.
How have bars in particular been impacted? I know they can't really do curbside pickup.
Well, yeah, the interesting thing with bars is, you know, many of them don't have a robust food program. And even those who do, that's not where they were making their money. But strangely enough, there's been this sort of relaxation of laws and takeout cocktails, margaritas and such, are now legal for this short time. Big Star over in Wicker Park is doing a brisk business in takeout margaritas that people are buying. They ran out at one point and they finally got them restocked. I just heard from a woman who owns Five Rabbit Brewery, Cerveceria, and they said that one way you can help them is by ordering beer for delivery. They're like, you know, it's legal for a short time. Those that have stayed open, and very few have, are trying to make a go of it with delivery cocktails.
Interesting.
Delivery beer.
Hmm.
Or pickup.
Now, right before Governor Pritzker ordered all bars and restaurants in the state to be closed for dine-in service, you were at a local chef's meeting in Bucktown where they were discussing all of this. What did you hear from those chefs, and what have you heard from them since the closures?
Well, you know, when this was, I watched or listened to the governor's address with them in real time as they got that gut punch that said everybody's closing down in, you know, in 48 hours. They were terrified for their industry, for their staff, sort of for the future of the culinary scene in Chicago. I mean, there was so much uncertainty. At that point, you know, the rules had not been laid out except for that very brief speech. And they're still terrified. Everybody was scrambling to figure out what to do with all of their highly perishable inventory and what to tell their staffs, you know, to tell people who are hourly workers who, you know, were living on pretty slim margins to begin with. You know, in the meantime, there have been some campaigns, but, you know, there's still a lot of uncertainty.
And it's not just the owners who are being hurt by these closures. Let's play a clip from your reporting here, Monica. This is pastry chef and Logan Square Pretty Cool ice cream owner, Dana Cree. She says there is an incredible amount of fear around this whole situation.
Fear that the people who rely on me for their means aren't going to have that and what that means for them. And then fear that should we have to shut down, that we won't be able to open back up.
Back out live, we're talking with Monica Ng of WBEZ. Monica, it seems like most of the owners you spoke with were concerned not only about the business as a whole, but of course for their employees too. What have you been hearing about or been hearing from restaurant employees?
Well, many have filed for unemployment, and they're waiting to hear what kind of local, state, and federal programs there will be for them. Whether it's they've already heard some about loan abatement, rent abatement, so that they don't necessarily have to pay off these big loans that they've had for expansion on the restaurant, or just people who need to pay rent on the restaurant or rent in their homes. Evictions have been held, and that helps. They're hoping to hear more about relief from payroll taxes. You know, some people have been kept on, you know, and it's kind of a dicey situation to be kept on, you know, continuing to go to work, continuing to deal with the public, even if people are, you know, trying to take the best steps. I talked to one restaurant owner here who, you know, he's doing curbside pickup, and it's basically his busboys who are learning to do it, and they need the money and they need the work, but you know they're out there every day and they're in contact with people. You know, it could be that other people could be a danger or they could be a danger. You know, it's tough. Everybody's kind of looking at the other person, saying, "Are you the one or am I the one?" You know, everybody just needs to stay 6 feet away from each other for everyone's own good. But we should also note that you do not get COVID from food.
And I know the governor said yesterday the unemployment offices, their computers crashed, and they're adding more resources to deal with all the influx of folks that are looking for benefits. If you're a restaurant owner or restaurant employee, perhaps you can join the conversation. Call us at 1-800-222-9455. Again, 800-222-9455. You know, Monica, Chicago is known as a great restaurant city. How do you think this whole situation with the coronavirus crisis will affect the overall food landscape in our state and there in Chicago for years to come?
Well, nobody knows at this point, but, you know, I've heard people pontificating saying maybe 40% of the restaurants that were alive before COVID will still be alive when we come out of this. Maybe it'll just be the strong chain. Maybe it'll, you know, like the small people who were kind of working on margins to begin with are not going to make it. Those who had sort of been planning for a rainy day may make it. But, I mean, most restaurants, they're working on sort of a month-to-month and very slim margins. So it does not bode well. I think it's going to be a very, very different restaurant landscape when we come through the end of the tunnel.
And have you heard about anybody putting together any sort of aid for folks in the restaurant industry to help them?
Yeah, there are a lot of those. Big Star actually started something through the Edward Lee Foundation that anybody can Google to help restaurant workers at this time. And they're going to be distributing packages of food on a first-come, first-served basis over there in Wicker Park at Damon and Milwaukee. There are big campaigns called Too Small to Fail, where they're asking people to call their federal representatives to please, for lack of a better term, bail out or give support, give stimulus to those in the hospitality industry. And then there are lots of smaller campaigns. I just wrote about one yesterday that really is touching people's hearts. There's a guy called Paul Boundis who's got a family restaurant out in South Suburban Chicago in Alsip, and he also runs a lot of school feeding programs where he makes delicious food from scratch for schools. It's just unbelievable. And when he heard that, you know, all of this stuff was going to shut down, he said, well, who's going to be taking care of the seniors? He said, he put it on Facebook. He said, do you know a senior who's going to have a hard time getting food during this, or anybody in a vulnerable population? Please tell me who they are. If they're in our area in the South Suburbs, we will bring them free food. He was overwhelmed by requests. The phone has been ringing off the hook. He's given out nearly 3,000 meals through volunteers who wear masks and gloves, and he just brings it to them. And there was this one 93-year-old man who I talked to who just couldn't believe it. It was even outside the area. It was in Frankfort, Illinois, in Will County. And the owner, Paul Boundis, showed up at his house with this food, and he said, I can't believe anyone would do this for me. So these really warm moments of people reaching out right now with food and with hospitality. But the hospitality business really needs the help, too.
Learned so much. Thank you, Monica Ng. She's a reporter from WBEZ in Chicago and Curious City. Monica, thank you for joining us on the 21st.
Thank you, and take care.
Much like food service, the music industry is one that relies on people physically showing up and spending money to survive. Sean Newman is a journalist and a musician. He plays guitar and bass in the Chicago bands Jupiter Styles and Rat Boys. Sean, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for speaking with us.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
It's going well. You know, when Governor Pritzker closed down bars and restaurants, that obviously impacted those bands and singers that kind of sing at them. You know, for especially those smaller groups, I mean, how has that impacted their livelihoods?
Yeah, I mean, it's been absolutely crushing. I think Monica painted a good picture with the kind of scrambling that a lot of restaurants in the Chicagoland area are doing right now to figure out how to make ends meet. And that's the exact same picture that we're seeing across most industries, which includes the live music industry as well. A lot of bands particularly depend on live music to make ends meet and make money. The bands don't really make any money pretty much through any like streaming services like Spotify or anywhere that you listen to music online. So they largely depend on touring and playing live shows every single night and selling merchandise and stuff like that and getting tips. That's how bands live. That's how I've lived for the past couple of years. And this has been, we've just been flipped on our head and we don't really know what to do. We're kind of scrambling and figuring out ways to survive right now. So, yeah.
How are people coming together to provide support? I've seen and heard a lot about these streaming live sets.
Yeah, you see a lot of, especially you see, like a lot of bigger musicians have been doing a lot of live streams, which has brought a lot of attention to the more local and like you mentioned, smaller bands that don't have the same crowd capacity. They've been doing live streams and stuff as soon as this started. So as soon as we found out that all of our touring plans pretty much for the rest of the year have been canceled, we started figuring out ways to do live streams or do we have any extra songs that we could put out online that, you know, people might be more willing to know we're in a time of need. So we've been doing live streams and, you know, like you can do a live stream on Instagram and you put up a little sign with your Venmo account and say, like, if you want to help out and if you like our music and, you know, you're supporting us and stuff like that, you can donate here. Some bands have put items on sale, like they've put albums on sale and stuff like that. Some streaming services have waived the fees that they typically take, which are usually very large, in an effort to help bands make more money. So there's been a lot of different ways, a lot of creative ways that people have been pooling their efforts to help get bands through this time.
And, you know, people are social distancing, and I guess you can't really just, you know, play in the same place that you normally rehearse in. You know, is this a time, though, that people can still make great music, even if they're just doing it, you know, via an app?
Yeah, we've kind of, because, I mean, we've all the musicians that we know, which is pretty much our entire network of friends, have all been like communicating a lot during this time, figuring out ways and, like I said, pulling efforts together. But we've all been joking that there's going to be so many like albums about the end of the world or something like that this time next year. Like when the next album cycle comes, all the records are going to be about, you know, the pandemic crisis and stuff going on. So I can definitely see some grim music coming in the future.
Not just R.A.M. song from years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Sean Newman is a journalist and a musician. He plays guitar and bass in the Chicago bands Jupiter Styles and Rat Boys. Sean, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
And stay tuned to the 21st and your local NPR station for this week as we continue to bring you the latest on news and analysis on the coronavirus. Tomorrow on our show, we'll be talking more about what COVID-19 testing looks like here in Illinois. And we have a quick break, but when we come back, we'll revisit our conversation about the documentary Stateville Calling.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Reginald Hardwick.
I don't think anybody deserves anything. You have to make yourself worthy of. Mm. So I won't say I deserve. Mm-hmm. I would say I've been working on making myself worthy of freedom. Mm.
That's a clip from a new documentary film called Stateville Calling. The voice you heard is a man named William Peoples. He's been incarcerated in Illinois for nearly 3 decades. The other voice in that clip is 84-year-old Bill Ryan. Bill is an advocate who helped abolish the death penalty in Illinois. He's since turned his attention to parole reform and advocating for prisoners like William Peoples. As the elderly prison population has grown, so has the cost to house and care for them. Illinois is just one of 16 states nationwide without a parole system. Advocates are now calling on the state to release elderly and sick prisoners in an effort to protect them from COVID-19, the illness caused by the coronavirus. They say older and chronically ill inmates pose little risk to the public, but are at great risk of contracting COVID-19 if they remain inside state prisons. Today, we wanted to revisit a conversation Lee Gaines had in January with the filmmakers behind Stateville Calling. Ben Kolick is the director of the documentary, and Yana Kunuchev is the producer.
Ben, Yana, welcome to the 21st, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us. It's exciting to get to share a bit about the project.
Yeah, so Ben, you know, we're going to talk more about Bill and William in just a minute, but first I wanted to ask, why did you want to make a film about parole reform?
We were approached actually by Bill's daughter some 4 years ago, and she actually was somebody that initially got Bill interested in the issue, which is touched on in the film. But Bill is a very passionate person and really wanted to get the voices of his friends, some of the incarcerated people featured in the film, out there. And initially, we were really focused on sharing their voices and perspectives as a lens to build empathy and understanding about incarcerated folks. And over the course of the film, this issue of parole reform and how we think about rehabilitation just came to the front and center as a real issue and kind of contradiction as far as how we think about ourselves as a society and our values. There's clearly some serious issues that if anyone takes some time to think about, they can't help but feel that something needs to be done, that something needs to be worked out or changed one way or the other.
Yeah, so it sounds like as you got to know your subjects that the film kind of decided its own evolution in a sense. Can you explain how the sentencing system currently works in Illinois? I think that there are some of our listeners out there who might be surprised that parole doesn't exist in the state.
Since 1978 in Illinois, there's basically not been parole. And it was in large seen as a progressive effort. What was happening is that there was a lot of correlation between race and class and whether or not somebody would get off on parole early or whether they would stay, you know, incarcerated for a very long time. So it was seen as some way a fairer solution to just give people a set amount of time to serve and then they would get out regardless of what their conduct was like while incarcerated, whether or not they were taking steps to rehabilitate themselves, show remorse for their crimes or the like. And so that was the shift, but the kind of the issue it has caused is that what incentive is there for someone who is incarcerated to rehabilitate or correct themselves? And I think that paradox gets at the heart of why would we even call it a Department of Corrections, you know, if there's really no methods or support systems in place or motivations for
right.
somebody that has committed a crime to improve themselves and want to rejoin a society. So yeah, in Illinois since 1978, there has not been a parole. There's still some people that have been incarcerated since before 1978 who come up before this parole board every you know, so often, but it's really only a handful left that fit that distinction.
Okay.
And
so I want to make sure that we're clear for our listeners here. There was a shift from what we might call indeterminate sentencing to determinant
right.
sentencing, which is that, you know, you're sentenced to prison and you have to fulfill the whole time that you've been sentenced to. And then also there's something that a term that I'm familiar with as someone who's reported on the prison system here in Illinois is something called mandatory supervised release, which often people kind of conflate with parole.
Right.
Can you explain a little bit what the difference between MSR, mandatory supervised release, and parole is, just so, you know, we can really explain to our listeners why Illinois doesn't have parole?
Sure. So what you're speaking about is essentially, for whatever reason, with a prison being overcrowded or perhaps as some kind of a easier bridge out, where people are still fulfilling their sentence, but they have an ankle bracelet or they need to check in or something like that, as opposed to having their sentence literally ended early, which would more fall into the older notion of parole, or having an indeterminate sentence where one would literally have their time spent shortened or got out earlier.
Okay. So, Yana, I want to talk a little bit about the central character in the film Stateville Calling, who is Bill Ryan. Can you tell us a little bit more about Bill? I understand he actually came from a social work background.
Yeah, Bill Ryan is a really interesting character. So he grew up in the South. He grew up in Kentucky. He was actually born on a tobacco farm, which we visit in the film. And his career took him to work with the State Child Protection Agency and as an administrator. And in that job, he saw a lot of, basically a lot of really terrible things that were happening to children. And his approach at that time to incarceration and to punishment was more in line with the tough on crime approach. He thought that, you know, maybe people deserve punishment. That was a way to sort of push people away from committing crimes. And then at one point, his daughter, who is an academic and someone who's really critical of incarceration, gave him a book that was basically about the death penalty and about a prisoner on death row. Ben, remind me the name of that book.
Dead Man Walking.
Dead Man Walking. And he read that and it kind of started him on a journey. He's also a really religious Catholic person. So he thinks a lot about like guilt and retribution and change. And that started him towards rethinking what it meant to put people on death row and to allow the state to kill people. And also through his daughter, he met people that were incarcerated on death row and actually became friends with them. And through that sort of came to be against the death penalty, and then from there an activist against the death penalty, and actually helped to work to eventually get the death penalty abolished in Illinois.
How did he make that transition from abolishing the death penalty to now reforming the parole system, or you know, the lack of parole system in Illinois?
Well, I think that when he came and kind of met and started his personal relationship with Rinaldo Hudson and William Peoples, it pushed him to take action. And through that, through meeting people that were involved in this, he basically sort of took it upon himself to help build that movement and to talk to legislators and to try and make that change on his own.
Yeah. Again, this is something that's touched on in the film, but after the real victories as far as curtailing death row in Illinois, it certainly was not the end of the fight for Bill. You know, he was eager, particularly now that he'd developed these close relationships, to start another battle. And it seemed clear that in some ways, in ending the death penalty, if there still is no eligibility for parole or release, it's like you've replaced, you know, one death sentence with another of being incarcerated.
I would love.
So that was where he really, you know, picked up with, okay, we need to think larger about some bigger structural reforms, and what better people to partner with on it than the folks that, you know, suffer the most from it, those incarcerated and their families.
Yeah, I think that is a wonderful segue to another clip that we'd love to play from this film. This is Alan Mills from the Uptown People's Law Center. He's actually been a frequent guest on the 21st show. And here he is speaking in front of the Illinois legislature.
I think about this as there being two different prisoners. Prisoner A goes through his sentence, violates every rule that he can think of, continually gets in trouble, has fights all the time, continues to use drugs or alcohol or whatever he can get a hold of. Prisoner B has never had a disciplinary report, completes his education, gets a college degree, holds a job in the prison responsibly, and is a model prisoner. They're both treated exactly the same under the current law. That means there's no incentive to be prisoner A over prisoner B. And that's the problem with not having parole. Parole allows you to treat them differently and provides the Department of Corrections with a tool to encourage the kind of rehabilitation I think we all want, so that when people get out, they don't go back in again.
Yeah, Ben, so I want to pick back up where we left off with that thought, this idea of, even though the death penalty has been abolished, life in prison without parole is its own sort of death sentence. I'm curious if you heard that expressed from any of the incarcerated individuals you spoke with for the film.
Certainly, it was a reoccurring theme, and you know, it really speaks to the harshness and inhumanity of our system in the United States, and you know how unique it is in the world, and particularly amongst first world countries, that we impose this kind of, you know, harsh punishment on people in a way that's costing us as a society a lot as far as the actual fiscal cost, and I think is also from a moral perspective. It's not serving anyone as far as a deterrent or keeping those people that are a threat to society away. As you know, what I hope we show in the film is that many of the people that are incarcerated are not a threat at all, and conversely have a lot that they could offer to our society.
Well, the other argument here that Bill and others have for creating a system of parole is actually a fiscal one, and that's because of the rising cost to house and care for the growing elderly population. As of 2015, the elderly prison population in Illinois was at 16.8%, or almost 8,000 inmates. Yana, I'm curious why that population is growing.
So that population is growing because that's the population that was brought into prison at the time when there were the most mandatory minimum sentences or tough sentences that kind of left people in a position where they would be serving really long sentences. So people going in now might not end up going in for quite as long. So that means that that elderly population has been growing at a higher rate than any other group of prisoners. So the cost has definitely been a big argument of advocates when as people age. It's more expensive to incarcerate them, so they need medicine, they might need wheelchairs or some other kind of daily assistance just to get through their day. So the numbers that I've been looking at from the Illinois Prison Project show that it costs about 2 to 5 times as much to incarcerate aging people in prison. People are also more likely to age faster, hit chronic illnesses faster because of a lack of good medical care, healthy food while they're incarcerated. So the estimate is that's about a third of the overall budget right now.
Wow, that's pretty significant. If you're just tuning in, we've been speaking with Ben Kolak and Yana Kunichov. They're the folks behind the documentary Stateville Calling, which explores parole reform here in Illinois. I also want to talk about one specific character in the film. Her name is Janet Jackson, and she's been incarcerated for more than 2 decades at Logan Correctional Center. So as she's been getting older, she's also faced a lot of health issues. Can you tell us a little bit more about Janet and why you were interested in telling her story in this film?
Janet is really someone special. She was incarcerated because of a really terrible a situation involving domestic abuse and some really poor decisions. And since then has really, devoted herself to being a leader and a community member in the prisons where she's been incarcerated. She first met Bill through his newspaper, Stateville Speaks, which he started with Rinaldo Hudson and some other folks as a way to build community and get their voices out. And Janet's been a frequent contributor. She's also earned many degrees while incarcerated, and really just done a lot to be a incredible neighbor within her community. I guess I would say, as far as telling her story, she's really been telling her own story through the newspaper for some time, and so we really just wanted to have a platform where she could share herself about the work she's been doing, and to let people know the reality of incarceration. One of my favorite lines in the film is when she says, "We are not Orange is the New Black." That the reality of the prison system is nothing like you see it represented in these Hollywood films, as far as the challenges people face and the kind of humble reality of these people that are just caught in this terrible system. And there's nobody coming in to save the day. It's us, the citizens, the taxpayers, the voters, that need to push for policy changes to make something more humane and, I think, align with what our values actually are.
That's Ben Kolak, director of the documentary Stateville Calling. We also heard from Yana Kunichov, who produced the film. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation about parole reform here in Illinois. I'm Lee Gaines. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Lee Gaines. If you're just joining us, I've been speaking with Ben Kolak and Yana Kunichov about their film Stateville Calling. The documentary follows 84-year-old Bill Ryan as he fights for parole reform in Illinois. Bill's advocacy work has included hundreds of hours on the phone with advocates, critics, and inmates alike. Here he is on a call with Rinaldo Hudson, who has been incarcerated for almost 30 years.
I don't only believe that I'm fighting for my life. I believe that I'm fighting for all the people that don't have voice, that haven't been convinced that it's possible to be guilty and to restore your life. I believe this, Bill. True restitution is getting out of prison and have to become a taxpayer and begin to actually pay forward toward helping someone else to be better with their life. What I'm saying, man, what makes people change is that they have to have someone to believe in them.
Okay.
And so many of us don't have anyone that we believe in us.
Okay.
Again, that was Bill Ryan speaking with Rinaldo Hudson in the film Stateville Calling. Illinois is one of fewer than 20 states nationwide without a parole system. Advocates pushing for parole reform point to a growing elderly prison population, which has put a strain on the state financially. I also want to make sure we talk about those on the other side of this issue, which in this case has primarily been the Illinois State's Attorneys Association. I would like to play another clip from the film here. This is Robert Berlin, president of Illinois State's Attorneys Association. You'll also hear from Rita Mayfield near the end of this clip. She's a state representative from Illinois' 60th district.
We maintain that any policy discussion regarding sentencing has to consider the cost of violent crime to society. The number of shootings, murders, and carjackings in Chicago alone are staggering in the past couple of years. Sentencing decisions were made by judges knowing when this person is going to get out. And if we institute parole, it takes away the consideration that prosecutors, defense attorneys, and judges have put into sentencing decisions.
Right, but you're saying case by case, but a white gentleman committing the same crime as an African American is more than likely to do less time. So there's still some problems within your case by case system.
In my experience, I can tell you in DuPage County, that's not the case. Race is never a factor in who is charged and what they're charged with and how they're sentenced.
So there is a lot to unpack in that quote, but I want to start with this idea of being soft on crime. Yana, does it seem like that is still something that people want to hear from their representatives, that they're tough on crime, or has that changed?
I think that really kind of depends on who you are, the relationship that you've had with policing in your own communities, and I think also the way that incarceration has impacted you and your community as well. I think that there's a lot of people who, I think particularly I'm based in Chicago, who have had to deal with some of the adverse effects of heavy policing and kind of stop and frisk style style policing that people see as and experience as really racially biased. Those are often sometimes the communities that are most impacted by crime. So I think that makes people more likely to want some kind of solution and to look to legislators to bring that solution forward. I also think there's I think legislators in Southern Illinois are from more rural communities. And I also think communities where prisons or jails offer jobs are, I think, impacted by that economic reality to also have a more tough on crime approach. So I think there's a lot of big contextual political issues that play into whether people still want a tough on crime response.
Yeah, so I want to address this issue of race head on. You know, Robert Berlin says race is never a factor in who is charged, but we know that's not entirely true. Correct, Ben?
I'm not a policy analyst or expert, but I think you can hear in the clip that, you know, the room erupts into laughter after he makes that point. So yes, I think that there's been quite a bit of really rigorous social science research that shows that that can't be the case, whether it's in DuPage County or the larger Chicago area or nationally, that there is a serious problem as far as how our criminal justice apparatus works that affects people of color, people you know, of different kind of class standings in a disproportionate way.
Yeah, so I think this film pretty well addresses the reality that exists here in Illinois when it comes to parole. But Yana, I'm curious, what have we heard from the governor about parole reforms? Have we heard much of anything at all?
Yeah, so we have a little, not specifically on parole reforms, but I think Governor Pritzker has actually been really interesting and just put out his 2020 criminal justice agenda. So obviously we started this film under the Rauner administration, who came at some of these issues from a more conservative place. So I think the what Governor Pritzker has put forward overall, I think, has made a lot of advocates excited. So he has talked about ending cash bail, about reforming low-level drug crime sentencing, and also reducing mandatory minimum sentences. So I think that is most likely to help a lot of people who are kind of heading, engaging with the criminal justice system now, rather than perhaps people who are still like living sentences that were given them in the 60s, 70s, or 80s. But I think it also is kind of a more positive environment for people who are trying to introduce new legislation or kind of continue trying to change the conversation around incarceration, particularly of elderly prisoners.
Yeah, so the other piece of this that we haven't talked about yet is the families of the victims. For the film, you spoke with Joy McCormick. Her son, Francisco Valencia, was murdered. Let's listen to Joy. You'll also hear Bill's daughter, Katie Ryan, near the end of this clip.
There were five people involved in Frankie's murder. Two of them were prosecuted. One of them was sentenced to 70 years and the other one 90 years, which essentially is a life sentence for a young person. On the other hand, my son's gone. The idea of giving someone another opportunity, another chance at life, I think that's a really tough ask.
You know, that's why this is such a heartbreaking conversation, because, you know, to care about the victim so often means to hate and to condemn, to isolate, to forget about the person responsible.
Again, that's a clip from the documentary Stateville Calling. Ben, why was it important to you that you included this perspective in the film?
Well, when we began the film, Bill, of course, was our initial in route and focus. And I think he really envisioned the project as being a strong call to action to bring about this, you know, parole reform, totally radically change the prison system. But the more we got into it, you know, we picked up on how many really complicated competing interests and concerns there are. And of course, the experience of victims is an important one. And I think one of the main factors that has shaped our current system, that one can't help but feel, you know, enormous compassion for someone who's the family that's lost a loved one. And, you know, we think, oh, we have to do anything and everything we can to try and address that. I think what hopefully comes across in the film, though, is how that can't trump everything. That can't be the end all decision maker. But it's just one factor that we need to weigh against the fiscal cost of that incarceration and the experience of the person, the perpetrator, and their family as well.
Yeah, Yana, I'd also like to get your perspective on this, too. Why was it important to bring the victims' families' voices into this story?
Well, I think just meeting sort of, we wanted to do this work at pretty rigorous journalistic standards. So part of that meant gathering data on this issue. It meant going into documents and looking at some of the crimes and that the people that we were speaking to that were incarcerated had committed. And I think that therefore talking to people on the other side of this issue. And also, I think just looking at the social power that victims advocates groups have, like, for example, you played the clip from the state's attorney, sort of weighing their voice in this discussion felt really, really important to us.
Yeah. So, you know, big picture here, what do you hope viewers take away from the film? Ben, we can start with you.
We want them to think about if rehabilitation is a right. Is that something that we, you know, as citizens really value and want our society, our states, our cities, our nation to invest in? That if for whatever reason someone commits a crime, that they have resources to rejoin society, and where, how do we best use those resources?
Yeah, and Yana, what's your take on that?
I think for me, you know, big picture, the U.S. incarcerates more people per capita than any other country. Black men are incarcerated at twice the rate of Latino men, three times the rate of white men. There's this huge criminal justice system. But I think what I'd love the film to show people is, first of all, that the system is huge and it's overwhelming, but it's not unchangeable. And actually, in the last few decades, it's changed considerably to bring us to the place where we are today. And I think that means that, you know, it's not out of the question that it could change significantly in the future, which I think would mean a lot for our use of resources and a lot of people's lives. I think also this spotlights to me how change works and like sort of what the work of that activism is. So I think seeing Bill, who is like a very charismatic, but also very much an elderly man, pushing to make these changes and to make all these connections, he does a lot of that just by like calling people on the phone, you know, kind of as like old fashioned tool, I think is sort of hopeful for me when I think about the future of criminal justice.
You know, speaking of changes and proposed reforms, Yana, what would you like to see happen? What are the most sensible solutions out there for parole reform?
Yeah, so from talking to advocates, I think there is definitely a tension between pushing for one community, like elderly prisoners who are least likely to reoffend, and that makes a strong case for their release. And then does that mean that it's harder to make a case for a broader group of incarcerated people who might not be as, who like the media might approach differently? So I think right now, the bills that I'm going to be watching, there's one that is either has already been introduced or just like is going to be introduced in the next few days by Will Guzzardi that offers incarcerated people release if they're terminally ill or medically incapacitated. So I think that speaks to some of the concerns about cost, but also kind of draws some clear lines of how people should be considered for this release. So I'm going to be watching that one closely. I think it'll be really interesting.
That was Lee Gaines speaking with Ben Kolick, the director of the documentary Stateville Calling, and Yana Kunuchev, the producer. The film, which focuses on the state's aging prison population and one elderly volunteer's fight to help them, Stateville Calling is featured in season 2 of Real Midwest. That's it for us today. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21st Show. We tweet out links after the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. We've also got our past shows on the 21st.org. We're produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Eunice Alpazon is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Reginald Hardwick. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thank you for listening.